Those of you who were here last Sunday morning will remember that we were once again treated to the Christmas pageant, the annual retelling of the Christmas story by a goodly number of our youngest church people. There are some remarkable elements to the annual Christmas pageant, not the least of which is that despite the telling of exactly the same story every year, no two are remotely the same. Something which is one of the most enjoyable features of any live dramatic presentation, I'd suggest. But at the same time, they are exactly the same. In fact, if the pageant were too different, we'd probably be disappointed. There's the same general plot line each year. But then there are always surprises. Sometimes whole new elements of the story are developed as shepherds argue. Angels burst into tears and magi appear much earlier than expected. One of my absolutely favorite Christmas pageants was one presented, was during the evening, not during the morning. And it featured the Holy Family consisting of a Cabbage Patch doll and Mary and Joseph, both of whom were under the age of 7. And we all watched with absolute fascination as Joseph fell asleep and slumped over midway during the pageant. It was a little past his bedtime. And he completely missed the arrival of the shepherds and the magi. And who knows, this may have actually been an accurate recounting of the story. Because, you know, it was a long walk for Joseph, and after the birth it may have decided that, you know, 40 winks was in order. So the pageant, it always offers a surprise or two as something goes horribly and wonderfully wrong. I'm regularly delighted by the casting because it's an all play. Everybody is given a role. Everybody. And even those who might not have a rich career in acting in front of them, they get a role. This year, I decided to sit at the back of the sanctuary. I hadn't done that before. And as sometimes happens, despite the best efforts of those doing the sound, portions of the dialogue, they just kind of faded away. Some of the characters were speaking in directions where mics were not. And for even those of us who use microphones regularly, it requires some discipline to use a microphone well. And on Christmas pageant Sunday, there are usually enough distractions that even the most studied of actors are challenged to be heard. Now, I have to say that this muffled dialogue was by no means a problem for me, because I knew exactly what was transpiring on the stage, because I know that story well enough, and probably most of you know that story well enough too. So when you see an innkeeper or a shepherd or an angel or a crowned figure from the east carrying a gift, you can probably fill in the lines without too much trouble. We know it because we've all heard it so many times. And so we kind of fill in the blanks where we need to. Then again, hearing something so many times can sometimes obscure what's being said. As I've said here before, this is been one of the more important learnings for me over the years, not just as a preacher, but just simply as a follower of Jesus. Just when I think that I've understood what's happening in a particular biblical passage, I bump into something new, and I have a where-did-that-come-from moment. Some line will leap out at me like I've never heard it before, or I'll stumble over a word that suddenly seems to draw attention to itself and its oddness. And there's a strangeness to it that somehow and mysteriously connects itself to my life. And I find myself once again drawn into a familiar story, just like it was the first time. But even if that's not your experience, I think we can all agree that this morning's gospel reading from Luke is kind of odd. And even in its familiarity, it's kind of odd. Visiting angels and pregnant virgins, these are not typical day in Qualicum Beach. At least not where I live in Qualicum Woods. But then again, the first chapter of Luke, it starts in a rather quaint but formal way. Luke writes this: "Since many have undertaken to set down an orderly account of the events that have been fulfilled among us, just as they were handed on to us by those who, from the beginning, were eyewitnesses and servants of the word, I too decided, after investigating everything carefully from the very first, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the truth concerning the things about which you have been instructed. Luke wants his audience to know that this is meant to be the straight goods. The historical facts offered by eyewitnesses. And then he proceeds to write about angelic visits. The first of which was to the priest Zechariah, who is married to a woman named Elizabeth. As Zechariah is doing his priestly work, the angel Gabriel appears. And unlike just about every Hallmark Christmas movie ever made, most of which I've watched in the last week, but as typically it is the case when angels visit people in the Bible, Zechariah is scared to death. In the Bible, angels usually scare people. I suspect their appearance is a little off-putting somehow. But even if they do look as cute as can be imagined, their message inevitably throws the recipient for a loop. That's what angels do. Angel means messenger. And in the biblical story, we usually read of them delivering a message. The message to Zechariah and Elizabeth being that they were going to have a child. Which was a bit of a surprise, because they were getting a little long in the tooth. They had not been able to conceive. It's another Abraham and Sarah story. But despite their age, Elizabeth becomes pregnant with a lad who will go on to be known as John the Baptist. And then we come to this morning's reading. It's 6 months later, and the story shifts to a visit by the same angel Gabriel, to Elizabeth's young cousin, whose name is Mary. And as one wise commentator has noted, this has got everything a tabloid magazine needs to be to get good circulation. Sex, religion, and royalty. It's got it all. Luke tells us that God sent the angel Gabriel to the town of Nazareth in Galilee, which is in itself kind of odd because Galilee was pretty much, well, it was nowheresville. In John's Gospel, when Nathaniel Riley asks, "Can anything good come out of Nazareth?" he was simply speaking what most people were thinking. Nazareth, not exactly the cultural hub of Israel. Which gets me wondering why Luke would tell the story this way if it wasn't just the way he heard it. Because its unlikeliness, its oddness draws attention to itself. Of course, then it gets even more strange. Gabriel is sent to bring news to a young woman named Mary who is engaged to marry someone named Joseph, whom we're told is in the lineage of none other than King David. Now, the Greek word used to describe her status, Mary's status, is parthenos, which can mean a few things, including being a young woman of marriageable age. And that sounds pretty good so far. Then Gabriel says, "Greetings, favored one, the Lord is with you." Interestingly enough, Mary's initial response suggests that maybe she might not be buying that. She's not so convinced she's either favored or that the Lord is with her, because Luke records her as being much perplexed by his words and pondered what sort of greeting this might be. Much perplexed. What a gentle way of putting it. Perplexed. The Greek word is diaterazo. And diaterazo means agitated greatly. Troubled greatly. I think Sue's translation was a more accurate one than mine. Actually, I would translate it this way. Mary was completely discombobulated. Gabriel gets this. So he says to her, "Don't be afraid, Mary. God's favoring you with a surprise. You will become pregnant and give birth to a son and name him Jesus." Seemingly oblivious to the fact that Mary's life has just been completely turned upside down, Gabriel just presses on. And he says, "He'll be great, he will be called the Son of the Most High, and God will give him the throne of his ancestor David. And what's more, he'll reign over the house of Jacob forever, and his kingdom will have no end. Well, there you go. How do you like that? And Mary says, how can this be? I've never been with a man. You see, she's not saying she is simply Parthenos, a young woman of marriageable age. No, she's being very clear. She's saying that in her case, Parthenos means she's not had sex. And I'm thinking she would probably be the one to know, right? Okay, so a little time out. We are all sophisticated people here, aren't we? We all know where babies come from, unlike those poor schlubs in first century Judea who just fell off the turnip truck. New. They might not have it all figured out on the cellular level, but the average Judean knew exactly how babies were conceived. They probably knew about it at a much earlier age than many of us, houses being smaller and less private then, if you catch my drift. Really. In fact, unlike a good many of us today, they had no illusions about how powerful this sex thing is. Which is why they actually had some prohibitions about sexual activity, but we'll save that for another sermon, which you may have noticed I'm accumulating at a great rate right now. But do note that this, as problematic as it might be for us sophisticated modern folk, this notion of Mary's pregnancy, in spite of her virginity, was indeed a part of the Christian story from its earliest days. Because there would be precisely no benefit in adding it later. And no, there is no disparagement of sex. There is no disparagement of women here. There is no disparagement of childbearing. It's not, none of that's implicit in this story, nor is there a suggestion of the state of perpetual virginity for Mary, and nor will those things appear in this sermon or any other. Thank you very much. What we do have is the introduction to the odd and mysterious nature of Jesus, who is both human and divine, right there at the beginning of the story. And so Mary asks, how can this be? Which just might be our question about this story too. How can this be? I mean, when was the last time that you asked that question of God? How can this be? You know, there's something going on in your life, something surprising, something disturbing, something that causes, how shall we put it, perplexity. That's one translation. Diatarazo, some great agitation, something greatly troubling, something completely discombobulating has gone on in your life. Some illness, some loss, some conflict, some disruption, which in turn raises this worrisome question. What's worse? That there's no meaning to what's going on in your life? It's just what it is? Or that there is meaning in this illness, in this loss, in this disruption, in this conflict? And somehow your story, even this part of your story, is actually tied to God's purposes. I mean, what if our lives aren't about simply pulling our own strings, being all that we can be and self-actualizing and defining for ourselves what success looks like? What if this is really all about discovering the role we're being invited to play in God's story? Within the Eastern Orthodox Church, Mary is referred to as Theotokos, the Greek name that means Mother of God or God-bearer. Like, wow. Try and get your head around that. God-bearer. What a singular honor for a human being to bear the Christ, to bring God to birth. Surely that is the most remarkable role ever cast in the story that God has written and is writing. honestly, I don't think that we in the Protestant end of the church have paid anywhere near enough attention to this, to Mary, the first disciple, the most blessed amongst all women, and I would dare say amongst all of humanity. But I would also suggest that the power of this morning's story isn't ultimately about this immensely brave and faithful young woman, but rather it illustrates how God graciously includes into the story God's writing, how God includes the most ordinary of people bearing God's purposes into this world. I mean, have you noticed that about the biblical story? The key players are odd. They're really unlikely. Jacob, he's a self-absorbed jerk. There's no way around it. He's horrible. Moses is a murderer. He is someone who's terrified of public speaking. And he's the one to lead the people out of captivity. Gideon is the least impressive member of the least important tribe, by his own admission. Peter is headstrong. He's mercurial. Saul, who will be remembered as Paul, he was a persecutor of the Christians. Why does God choose the odd ones and not the stars? Why did God choose a young woman from an obscure town in a most unimportant part of Israel? And I thought really, really careful about this. And here's my answer. You've got me. I have no clue. What I do know is that God chooses unlikely people, sometimes odd people, to play roles, to in some way bear God in his unfolding story. So why did God choose you or me? I don't know. I honestly don't know. What I do know is that you're here this morning, here on the fourth Sunday of Advent, on the brink of Christmas. There are many other places you could be. And that suggests to me that you are not only chosen, but you've said in some way, well, here I am, servant of the Lord. So here we are. I dare say a rather odd and unlikely group of disciples, but here we are. Are you up for the task? Are you ready to play your role in God's story? Me neither. But here you are. And as Mary was reassured, nothing will be impossible with God. To that I say, with some perplexity, thanks be to God. Amen.